we will try again to study the Talmud in the method of Talmudic analysis, which is a very specific method, and which also opens up, as we go along, you'll see it opens up the verses themselves, and it really teaches you how to study a verse in the Torah. You know, I always say that as much as, you know, the Torah always respects creativity, and I always try to uncover new ideas when I learn, but if I don't cut across the paths of the Talmudic scholars, I'm very leery of what I say, because their paths are main highways of understanding, and if you're on target, you should meet them at certain points. If you don't, you know, anybody could say whatever they want, but how true it is another question. They have to have some kind of verification. The interpretation of Torah, as you know, was given over to Moses, and then the scholars, and the Talmudic method is a very important part of this interpretation. So we're going to go back to the Talmud and to the seven laws. I'll just begin with a little story, which if you people, you know, we did study the Talmud Sanhedrin last winter. And I think that you may be able to answer this question that came up in this incident. My son is studying in law school in Cardozo Law, and in one of his courses, he noticed an older fellow, must have been like close to 80, sitting in the class. So he was a little, you know, surprised. Most of the people there are young students, and he was very curious about this elderly fellow. So one day went over to him and he said, you know, are you here as a part of the program? So he said, no. He said that the professor of this course is my nephew. And he said that I'm really retired. I received my law degree some 40 years ago, and I was practicing all my life, but now I'm retired, and I come here because I just enjoy to listen to my nephew teach the course. He says, I like to go, you know, I'm always intellectually curious, and as a matter of fact, he says, I often attend Talmud classes. And it turns out that this fellow is a law-abiding, practicing, law-abiding Jew, observant Jew, and he enjoys going to Talmud classes. So he says to my son, he says, you know, he says, the Talmud is when it comes to law. So my son asks him, why is it difficult? So he says, well, you know, there are certain laws there that don't make too much sense. So he says, well, for instance, so my son said, what? So he said, well, he says, for instance, if two people kill someone, so they both go free. Okay, now here we have, this is a Talmudic law. And the law states as follows. Let us say there is a rock that is, I'm going to give an example, there's a rock, very heavy rock on top of a building. And one person cannot push the rock over. It requires two people. That is a man sitting down by the side of the building, and two people push the rock over the edge. And the rock kills the man. But neither one would be able to do it on his own. So according to the Talmudic law, both go free. Why? Because you can't ascribe the action to any one individual. See, Talmudic law is very exact and very logical. In order for a person to be culpable for the death penalty, he has to be the one that actually did the deed, the action. Now, if he couldn't have done it on his own, he's not culpable. He didn't accomplish it. Each person is a separate entity. Each human being is, you can't take two human beings and lump them together and make one human being out of them and say, well, this combination is going to suffer the death penalty. You can't do that because there's no such thing as two people being one. Each individual has to be singularly guilty. So it's a logical problem, and of course, according to pure logic, there is no one individual that is culpable, so They both go free. So this fellow says to my son, he says, well, you see, that's not really logical. And in American law, while in American law, there's a different problem than American law. In American law, there's no inconsistency on a theoretical basis of the law. Originally, they tried to do that. They tried to make laws that are rational and that are logically consistent. But then they found out that it's an impossibility. They can't do it. And they abandoned the theoretical, logical consistency of law for the sake of practicality of law. So today, law is really more of a practical thing. Whether a law is going to be passed or not is more dependent on how it will affect society than at large than upon how just or logical it is. So the criteria for American law are quite different than the criteria for Talmudic law. Talmudic law is completely, the law of the Sanhedrin is completely, must be internally consistent. And if it's not logical, that's it. So no one's guilty. So this fellow told my son, he says, well, you see, the Talmudic approach, which insists on logical consistency in society, doesn't make any sense. How can you let two people go free? So my son said, he said to the fellow, this question has already been raised. And as a matter of fact, he mentioned one of the scholars called the Ran, and the Ran is one of the Rishonim. The Rishonim are the medieval scholars, and the medieval scholars are really the greatest. They're the basis of our understanding of Talmud, because they comb through the Talmud, brilliant men. And you will not find any errors, and practically never in anything they wrote. They had the entire Talmud recorded in their minds, and they were extremely logical and abstract thinkers. So they're really the foundations of our understanding of Talmud. And when you go through, if you go through these, you study the Rishonim properly, they usually bring out every possibility that there is in the Talmud. And they take various opinions, but the important thing is the impossibilities that they bring out. It has hardly happened in centuries that anyone, no matter how bright, was able to come up with something new that the Rishonim hadn't already raised. I mean, it did happen, but it's very, very rare. Very rare. So one of these Rishonim is called, we call him the Ran, it's an acronym, and his name is Rabbi Nissim, so we abbreviated his Ran. The Ran states, as a matter of fact, he says when a person studies the Talmudic system of law, he will find that many laws of countries make more sense than the laws of the Sanhedrin. So this fellow got so excited when my son said that. He said, you're the first one that ever admitted to me, that there is a deficiency in the system. And he got so excited, he didn't even wait around to hear the answer to his question. You know, how could it be? I mean, you can't just leave it that way. How could God's law be imperfect? But he was so elated that there was someone that raised the question. He says, and all these people that tell me, they keep on insisting that it's, no, the Talmudic law makes more sense. He says, you see that? They're wrong, and they're just trying to defend themselves. But he says, you're the first one that admitted that there's a problem here. So the next time they got together, he reminded himself that he hadn't really gotten the answer. How is it possible to say that God's law is deficient in any way? So then he came back and he asked my son what the answer is. But you people remember some of our studies over the past winter. I think you should be able to answer this question that this fellow asked. By the way, it is not those who are truly scholars of Talmud never force an answer. We don't force answers. If it doesn't make any sense, we would rather admit that we don't know than to try to force, create an ad hoc answer just to fit the question. We aren't afraid to say we don't know, we don't understand, and we'd rather keep our minds clear and straight than to try to force, like a theologian, just force anything in there, whatever, just to save the religion. We don't have to save God's religion. If we don't understand it, we don't understand it. That's it. Good question. Many Rishonim and many of the Talmudic scholars had brilliant questions. Was just left. They didn't understand it. One of the famous ones is how Ezekiel fits in with the with the sacrifices in the Leviticus. And the Talmud says, we don't know. That's what it says when the Messiah comes, we'll explain it to us. We don't know. But the Talmud is always very honest and straightforward, and we don't corrupt our minds in order to... We're not in the press. We don't worry about saving the religion. God doesn't need any help. We don't understand. We don't understand it. But many people feel an obligation to say, no, we're right, you know. He's an intelligent guy, obviously, and he sensed that they were trying to defend it religiously, and he appreciated the fact that my son said, no, he says, you're right, the question is a good question, it's raised by the Ron, and he says openly that many, if you study many societies, and then you study the Tractate of Sanhedrin, you'll find in certain times, not always, but certain times, you'll say, well, look, it sounds like the law of the land is more just than the law of the Torah, like in the case he gave. But the answer is, and some of you may know, I don't have a video here, so I can't see if anybody's raising their hands, but if somebody wants to give the answer to this question, I would certainly be more than happy to allow them to have the floor. I can't tell, though. I'll just wait on a minute.
Okay. Yes. No one is raising their hand, so...
Okay.
Ray Revis raised his hand, but I don't think he's qualified.
That's okay.
Okay, so you may continue.
Okay. Now, the answer is, you remember, we studied the case of Judah in Genesis. And in the case of Judah in Genesis, we went through why he said that Tamar had to be burnt at the stake. First of all, this is not the kind of death that the Torah prescribes. And she really didn't do anything other than prostitution is not subject to the penalty, to the death penalty. As a matter of fact, prostitution, where it is prohibited in Israel, but there is, it's not one of the seven laws. So why should she be subject to the death penalty? So if you remember the way Nachmanides explained this, Nachmanides mentioned that Judah was a king in the area that he resided. He was a very respected person, and he, when he moved to that location, he became, they made him a king. And there is a law that... There is a law that if a person, so then the king can punish them with a death penalty, even though it's not part of the system of the seven laws. I'm not interested right now in the case over there with Judah. That's a specific which we went through last time. I'm just using it to bring up the whole concept. And the concept is, it's a concept that B'nai Israel as well as for B'nai Noach. And if you remember when the people asked Samuel for a king, so the people said that, they said to Samuel, and the king, our king will judge us. That was one of the things that they said. Our king will judge us. And so the Talmud is very careful, and no word in the Tanakh is wasted, and the Talmud states that when the people said that they wanted a king because they wanted him to judge them, so the Talmud says that that is really one of the reasons that a king is, one of the valid reasons that people have a right for a king. So the question, of course, is, I'm trying to find where the verse is, but the question... why do they have to have a king judge them? If, oh, here it is. It's in Samuel 1 Samuel 8:20. It says, and we will be like the other nations, and our king will judge us, and he will go out before us, and he will wage our wars. So Maimonides states, of course, from the Talmud, that there are two reasons that we appoint the king. One is in order to, is for judgment, and to judge the people, and second one is to do battle. Okay. Now, I'm not going to go on right now to the question of what was wrong with their request, because you see that Samuel, that God was angry at them, and Samuel was angry at them for requesting a king. That's a separate thing. But there is a legitimate request for a king, and the legitimacy is expressed in that verse, 1 Samuel 8:20, to wage war. All right? Nachmanides, basically, in my opinion, the clearest answer, because he says that at that time, God through prophecy was really the one that was giving them advice on waging war. So that's why it was improper at that time to ask for the king. And judgments were done by Samuel. But I'm not interested in that point right now. What I want to bring out, and that is the final halachic conclusion, is that the king is there for judgment, to judge the people. And as you know, the king Messiah judges the people, as is mentioned in Isaiah. That's one of his main attributes, that he judges the people justly. And he'll be, as a matter of fact, he'll be such a great mind that he'll be able to discern immediately who is telling the truth and who is lying, because of his brilliance, like Solomon did. And that's one of the characteristics of the king. So the question, of course, is, what do we need the king to judge if you have already the Sanhedrin? And the answer is that there are two systems of law, that two institutions of judgment that exists in the Jewish nation. And one is the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is a system of law that is purely halachic. It means it is rational, it is perfectly internally consistent. Every point has to work out with every other point. And that's a totally logical system that God gave, and a very intricate and abstract one. Okay, but systems that are so logical and internally correct must of necessity be lacking in the pro. That just is the fact, that it can't be otherwise. That's the way it is. So therefore, what God did was he supplemented the system of the Sanhedrin with the system of the king. The king is really a supplemental system. So let us say, for instance, I was speaking with David about this. Let us say, for instance, in the O.J. Simpson case, okay? So over here, let's say you find circumstantial evidence, 100% conclusive that O.J. committed the murder, if that is the case. Then, according to the Sanhedrin system, you couldn't do anything because you need a witness. But there, you see, that is a case where the king, if he can prove that the person was a murderer, he would be able to execute him. So therefore, what the king did was, you see, the king didn't interfere with every case. Generally speaking, the Sanhedrin was fine. But the king had to determine when to move in order to keep the entire system just. Like, let us say, for instance, one of the laws by Ben Israel, one of the laws, it was very difficult, as you know, to execute anybody in the Sanhedrin system. One of the things that was necessary before the person committed the crime, he had to have two witnesses warning him not to do it, and that if he does it, he will suffer the death penalty. And not only that, but the person had to respond and say, I don't care, I'm doing it anyways. If he didn't say, I'm doing it anyways, you still couldn't execute him. So you see, it was a very strict violation. You killed him for the rebellion against the system. That was part of the death penalty, was because of his rebellion against the system. He said, I don't care. So that was necessary. So it was a very strict, rigid system, and many times that wasn't enough. So then the king, he had to assess the political situation, the people, whether it's a state of lawlessness or whatever. Well, he had to use his wisdom to determine if the Sanhedrin was not enough. There were times where the Sanhedrin could have been fine, because the people, you have to understand that the people of Israel with 613 commandments were, at one time, there were very few murder cases. So, because you're speaking about a system where people are raised with the 613, and they're, you know, and they're schooled, and they're studying Torah, and they keep all the commandments, and if they fail, for instance, to put up a sukkah, then the Sanhedrin, they would force them to do that. It would coerce them. And there were so many laws there that there were times when there were hardly any gross crimes, because the society was functioning so well. But at other times, that's not the case. So this the king has to assess. And the king has a right to, he has a free rein, so to speak, to use his wisdom in establishing justice. So therefore, so that's exactly what my son taught. And this is the same thing, by the way, for the Ben Noach, as we mentioned from the case of Nachmanides with Judah and Tamar. He was instituting the king's law. He wasn't instituting the seven laws of Noah. The seven laws of Noah, which work by a court system, which would be the analog of the Sanhedrin, will be in the case of the Ben Noach. The Ben Noach had the court system, but he also had the kingly system as well. So Judah was functioning as a king. So you see, the God's law is not lacking, and these two systems complement each other. It says that the King Messiah will judge the people. It means he will do what he did to bring a state of law, law-abiding citizens, and create a society that's conducive to the advancement of knowledge and the good for humanity. So he has to use, that's not the Sanhedrin, he has to use his own intelligence on that. So the Torah very well recognized that the Sanhedrin alone is not enough. But the reason for the Sanhedrin is because the Sanhedrin's laws are halachically pure, and they're logically consistent, and they're very beautifully structured. So we try, insofar as we can, to use that system, as those laws are very perfected in their structure, very exact. But many times, because of the exactness, you can't really, you're going to let a lot of criminals go because of the precise details of the law. So then the king has to step in. But it's important to retain the system of Sanhedrin, because those laws are extremely beautifully formulated. That's God's legal system, and we don't want to throw that away. So we have the two systems functioning simultaneously. One of them is the perfected system of law, and where that fails because of practice, the kingly system moves in.
So, Rabbi?
Yes?
In the example that you gave, could the king, I'm trying to adjust the volume, because people are getting this tape, they just got blowed out. Could the king, in that circumstance, when they knew that one or both of the men killed the guy by pushing the stone, could the king intervene in that situation?
Absolutely.
And rule?
Yes, death penalty. Yes.
Okay.
The situation could move in and could execute the two. In the case where the two killed someone, the king would have a right to move in if he saw fit and execute the two. And the same thing, of course, on a practical level, getting back to the O.J. Simpson case. The king could judge based on circumstantial evidence if he saw fit. If he saw a famous individual that everybody looks up to, and the technicalities of the court would not be able to convict him, yet everyone knows that he's a murderer and he's going free, the king would step in, and in the Ben Noach situation, and would execute the man, because you can't allow flagrant violation of justice to exist in a society without it affecting the entire society. So there the king would definitely move in. On the other hand, the king might not be involved in every little case. You see, he wouldn't be involved in every little case. We'd go in according to the same thing with the Ben Noach. We'd go in according to the courts of the Ben Noach. Now, the courts of the Ben Noach work according to the halacha. So they also are bound by a very strict system. And the king wouldn't step in ordinarily unless he sees fit. He has to assess the society. He has to do things. His objective is to make sure that the society is law abiding. That's his objective, and he has to use his wisdom and his intelligence and his knowledge to do as he sees fit. So there you have that is really the Torah system. On the one hand, we're attached to God's perfect laws.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
I want to do three things and see if we got it here. Number one, what you said, if the two men killed someone, regardless whether they had been Israel or Ben Noach,
right,
then the Sanhedrin is to find them guilty.
Right. No, the Sanhedrin would not be
able to. Excuse me, the Sanhedrin would find them innocent.
Right.
Then if there was a king in the land,
right,
then the king would have to render the judgment.
But
what if there was a Sanhedrin and no king, then they would be under the judgment of the hand of God.
And that's it. Exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly
Thank you.
Right. And that's exactly right. There is a time, if there is no king, and when there's only the Sanhedrin, then that's true. Then he's under. Then the man, the Bible says that the Bible says one of the laws is if a man is, let's say, the Sanhedrin, for instance, goes through a case thoroughly, and they went through every case very thoroughly, both from the halachic standpoint and from the practical facts. And let us say they made a judgment that someone is innocent. So then they find out a month later they made a mistake. You can't bring him back anymore. He comes under God's judgment. There are certain human judgment is fallible, and we recognize that. And there are no claims to Torah for infallibility. Even Moses, the greatest teacher, made mistakes. Every human being makes mistakes. And the idea of judging, actually the idea of judging another human being, we only do it because it's necessary and it's impossible for society to exist without that. The only real judgment that we respect, of course, is God's judgment. That's the only real judgment. But from a practical standpoint, it's impossible to have a society without judgment, so that's why we have to have the Sanhedrin. But sometimes they're helpless, and they say, well, now he's under God's judgment, as David mentioned. And that is correct. That is correct. There are times like that. If the Sanhedrin tries the case, of course, then the man is free. But the king can intervene and say, just a moment, this is a case. This case comes under my jurisdiction. I feel it is necessary for the society to try this case. And then he could try the structural laws of the Sanhedrin is limited by. Okay, so that's an important thing. Now that we know there are two systems, so what we're going to do now in studying the seven laws, we must keep in mind that what we are studying here in these seven laws is not the laws.
Rabbi?
Yes.
All right, we have another question here from Jimmy Carver. Now, Jimmy, state that again. Come here and talk in the phone. Okay, the question is, the Sanhedrin gave a ruling. Then can the king step in? And you stated, I believe, that after the Sanhedrin is ruled, the king cannot overrule except in a miscarriage of justice. If the Sanhedrin, yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, once the Sanhedrin rules, that's it. You can't. If the Sanhedrin rules innocent, then the man is innocent. The king can't move in after that. Cannot do anything about it. He has to take...
Okay, well, let's stop right here and just turn the tape over while we're right here.